Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Ellefson for the Digital Education Podcast, really the place where I get to have conversations with educators, researchers, policy people, innovators, but mostly just friends that I've known for a short period of time and friends that I've known for longer. Today's guest, Kara Stillings-Kendell, I've known since 2005 when I moved to Boston, and she was an older student with me at, I guess not older student, but further along in the process at Boston University. Currently, she's a senior fellow at Pioneer Institute and author of a new book called The Fight for the Best Public Charter Schools in the Nation, which takes a look at Massachusetts charter schools in the recent history and then even taking a look at their future. So, Kara, thanks for being with me. One of the questions I want to start with you right away is, what drew you originally into policy, and then why charter schools?
Yeah, thank you, Eric. I'd like to point out, too, that I think, unfortunately, I was not only further along in the process, I think I was older and am older, so for better or for worse. So what drew me to policy, and then what drew me to charter schools? I was heavily drawn to education policy and to start our doctoral work together at Boston University, just really in part because of the circuitous path I took to education policy in my early 20s. So like so many of us, I started off as a teacher. I taught high school English, and I taught English language learners in tons of different places, not only in traditional school settings, but in factories outside of places like Detroit and Chicago, adult language learners. And I also, I was able to travel pretty extensively in my 20s speaking English. And one of the things that I observed in my travels was just how different education systems were from place to place. I was really intrigued by that. I went to study that in graduate school through my master's degree in anthropology of all things at the University of Chicago. And after that, dabbled with a bunch of student loans, I actually landed a job in educational testing, which at the time was pretty new. This was just like 2001 and No Child Left Behind. And I really had no clue what I was getting into, but I became a test development specialist and got to travel around the country designing standardized tests for states. Now, some days now when I reflect on that, I wonder, you know, sort of where I'm going to go for my participation in the standardized testing, large-scale assessment regime that we have today. But it was just the most fascinating job. I learned so much, and it got me really, really interested in school policy, because I spent all of this time working not only with wonderful people in different state departments, but also with teachers. I spent a lot of time working with teachers. And I really was able to see just firsthand sort of the disconnect between what we understood at the time and probably still understand about what students can do and how they learn, and the disconnect between that and the policies that that try and, you know, dictate where kids go to school and what kinds of schools they'll have access to. And so that's what landed me at Boston University, where you and I met. And how I got into charter schools, well, I have a very distinct memory. And so you know very well our friend, our mentor, our colleague, Charlie Glenn, who is one of the just foremost experts on educational choice in the entire world. He's actually sort of like a tease in that he's like a rock star in Europe. And I remember very distinctly having this conversation with Dr. Glenn when we were doing our comprehensive exams and feeling very sort of depressed, as many of us do when you study things like the achievement gap for a long time, you know, and saying to him, like, it just seems like there's no solution to this. Like, how are we ever going to get to a place where kids, especially low-income children of color, have the access that they need to receive a high-quality education and have other opportunities in life because of that. And I remember he said to me, you know, sometimes, Kara, you need to look for bright spots in what's otherwise sort of a dark cloud. And he said, right here down the street from us, there's this new charter school that opened called the Match Charter Public School. At the time, it hadn't been around for very long. And he said, you know, I hear rumors that they are doing phenomenal things, that most of the kids they serve are from low-income communities, most of the children they serve are children of color, and that they are like just blowing it out of the water and closing achievement gaps in ways that we haven't seen before. And so I went to visit that school and it opened up a whole new world for me of interest in, like, wow, what does it take to create a really high performing school? And then beyond that, how are these charter schools, are they different? And if so, how? And so that's how I ended up, you know, many, many years later, writing this book.
So in this book, you talk about, you know, the lessons that have been learned over the last 10 years. And you talk about two areas where you feel like Massachusetts got it right. And I don't necessarily want, I enjoyed a term that I think you used was called generous autonomy and strong accountability. Mm-hmm. How do those things, especially from a policy level, we're so used to having these conversations about running schools and building schools. And I want to ask the innovation question next, but how did Massachusetts get it right where they set up the appropriate amount of autonomy, but then also, you know, some of those standards are holding those schools or those charter networks accountable?
Yeah. So, yeah, this is, I think, where Massachusetts really got it right. And, you know, charter laws are different across the country. And what I think is really special about the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is that we have, much more than many other places, held true to the spirit of the charter school bargain that Ted Coldery first outlined, and that, you know, the folks in the great folks in Minnesota, like Joe Mason and even Al Shanker, your Al Shanker, I remember you studied him a lot, you know, talked about. And that was that they had identified this problem that was increasingly over time. All of our schools, our public schools in particular, had really become these lumbering bureaucracies and were highly regulated in unproductive ways. And so the charter school bargain says, schools need autonomy to be able to function, to be able to do things differently, to be able to meet the needs of diverse populations. You know, you can't just like say, well, one school is just like the next, or one kid or one population is just like the next. They wanted to enable schools to really meet the needs of distinct communities, and to also be like new and distinctive places that parents and students could get excited about. But they fully understood that on the other end of that, if you gave schools a lot of autonomy, you had to account for schools that weren't going to use those autonomies really well. And so Massachusetts has basically said, we are going to give our charter schools real autonomy. We're going to say, you know, the calendar of the school year, that is in your hands. The length of the school day, that is in your hands. The people who you choose to hire, how you train them, whether or not you fire them, all those things are going to be in your hands. And here in this heavily unionized area of the country, you know, our charter public school teachers can opt in to a union. They can choose to unionize, that is their right, but they don't have to. And teachers unions have very strong presence here, not always in a good way, sometimes in good ways, but not always in a good way. But then the other part of that bargain is that Massachusetts holds our charter schools accountable. So I'm sorry, getting things here. It says that when our schools are failing to meet the terms of their agreements, meaning student performance isn't going well, or even if they're not delivering the innovative programs that they promised, then they have to close because they're not serving kids well. And the idea is that they have to do things better. They really have to meet a higher standard of accountability for kids. And where other states have either sort of overregulated charters and not given them the autonomy that they need to do things differently, or have failed to close charters when they don't do things well, Massachusetts has really held true to both aspects of that bargain: real autonomy in exchange for real accountability.
So did you see that they actually closed schools, or they actually took charters away from certain schools?
Oh, absolutely. So over time, we've revoked, I believe that the Commonwealth has revoked 5 charters, meaning they've just, when charters have applied for renewal, they've said, you know what, you are not meeting standards, therefore you have to close. And that could be they're not meeting standards for kids, or maybe they're not financially viable, which is also important. And then we also have other schools that have simply handed back their charters in advance of having it revoked. So they've been given the opportunity to say, we're not able to live up to the terms of this charter bargain, therefore we're going to give this charter back. And, you know, one thing I think is important to address is I often get the question from folks, well, so what happens to kids when these charter schools close? I mean, you might remember back in 2016, John Oliver, who I actually find to be very funny, he had this like huge rant against charter schools on his show. And one of the things he went on and on about was that, oh, all these charter schools are closing. He wasn't talking about Massachusetts. But the point being that a responsible authorizer like we have in Massachusetts always takes care to ensure that when a charter school must close, that families and students have other options to choose, and that they help to ensure that those families, you know, I mean, they're given plenty of notice and they're given care and feeding in the process of choosing their next school.
So we got there, and you know, the early 2000s to the mid 2000s, those were pretty great times to talk about charter schools, mm-hmm. talk about choice, yeah. talk about policy. I mean, it was a really fun time, but then it seems like things tightened up, people's interests changed, maybe some of even the finances, you know, financial kind of interests changed a little bit. And then you talked a little bit about in 2010, how, you know, the Commonwealth narrowed the law, you know, decreasing or, yeah. or putting, you know, making it more, you know, making the law more stringent, and then really decreasing the opportunity for schools to be more innovative or for new innovative options to open and to develop. Like within the last, you know, few years, especially since that 2010, you know, law, like what are you seeing now when we're at, you know, 2017, 18, and now 19, like what's changing and what does like the near future look like for these charter schools in Massachusetts?
Yeah. Well, first of all, what does it look like now? You know, in some respects, the success of charter schools has been their Achilles heel, in that, they've been, people took notice, and people who didn't want charter schools took a lot of notice, and it created a very contentious environment here in the Commonwealth, so much so that, as I write in the book, we had an initiative to lift the charter school cap in 2016 that went to ballot, and it resoundingly failed, in part because the teachers' unions here are very, very against any expansion of charter schools, in large part because the most charters here are not unionized. And it wasn't just that, or it isn't just that certain groups of people don't want charter schools, don't like the freedoms and autonomies that they have. It's that it's just incredibly contentious. So that part of what happened in our 2010 law, when we tried to raise the cap, it was a lot of political sausage making, and we said only these proven providers, proven operators can open new schools in underperforming districts. We emphasized replication over innovation, but at the same time, what we said, we sort of painted charter schools as an escape valve from districts that weren't working, which really, it's understandable that just gives charter opposition more ammunition to really hate charter schools. It's sort of like, oh, here, you know, charter schools are coming to save kids from these terrible districts, which isn't always the case, right? So where we're at now is this just incredibly contentious environment. And it's unfortunate because it's also filled with lots of misinformation, so that your average voter, your average citizen, you know, it's a small percentage of our overall population that consumes charter schools here in Massachusetts. And those who don't use them, I think not only for the most part don't understand what they are, but also have a negative impression of some of the impacts that charter schools have on district schools, which in many cases, in the vast majority of cases, is just, these impressions are demonstrably false. They're sort of myths that exist about charter schools, but they're very ingrained sort of in the public imagination. So in terms of next steps, you know, it's been very quiet here. It's been radio silent for the 2 years since this ballot initiative and the failure to lift the cap. In our election just 2 days ago, Governor Charlie Baker was reelected overwhelmingly in a landslide victory to a second term. And he has been a very pro-charter school governor. I think that those of us who are really interested in reigniting the conversation about charter schools are interested in two things. And one is that we really want to reset the tone about charter public schools in the Commonwealth so that it is less contentious and bring it back to those original principles of charter schooling. And, you know, how can charter schools be innovative options for all parents and for all students who want them, not just for a certain subset of the population. So that's number one. And within that is trying to provide people with really empirical data and evidence to dispute this disingenuous information that charter schools are somehow harming districts. In case we have study after study that shows that in many cases they're boosting district performance and district finances for that matter. And I think that the next step in sort of the politics of chartering, like any attempt to have more charter public schools in Massachusetts, is really going to have to be tied to a larger sort of education reform 2.0 package that addresses not just charter public schools, but all public schools in the Commonwealth. So it's really time for a conversation here about how we improve our funding formula, which is very progressive, but there's a lot of room for improvement. And then I think as part of that, as we've learned, as you all know, Eric, as we've learned from 25 years of education reform, throwing money at schools doesn't solve problems, but some schools do need more money, and what works is that when we attach that money to expectations for what schools will do or how they'll use that money to benefit children and, you know, what they have to do to prove that they're performing well or trying to perform well in order to receive that money. So I hope that charter schools can be part of that larger funding conversation, not only to ensure that they receive the equitable funding that they are due, but also to ensure that, you know, there are no, we can truly end this conversation that charter schools somehow have a negative impact on district funding or district financing.
So let me ask one last question then, because I mean, when we look at this and you talk kind of like, you know, education policy 2.0 and some of these changes, and then we look at, you know, No Child Left Behind that then feeds into ESSA, and Massachusetts, along with Texas, California, Florida, and maybe New York, has a huge impact on education policy nationally. Like, so, mm-hmm. So what do you see, you know, that's whether it's coming out of Massachusetts or whether it hits nationally, or what's the next steps even nationally when we look at, you know, where we're at from a policy standpoint, and then how does some of this that's going on in Massachusetts connect in with some of that larger picture around the country?
Yeah, I love that question. I think, yes, Massachusetts has in the past 25 years really, really been a leader along with some other states in education reform. And I think that there are a couple lessons that other states could do well to learn from Massachusetts generally and with regard to charter policy. And one of the huge lessons in both arenas is accountability. And right now, accountability as we knew it under No Child Left Behind has really gone out of vogue. People are, you know, tired of overtesting. They're tired of standardized tests. We want to see new and different ways to assess what students know and can do and to give them new and diverse opportunities that are more than just this sort of narrow focus on standardized testing. But I think that what we can learn from the Massachusetts lesson is that you can have that without letting go of accountability. And what I see in a lot of state ESSA plans is sort of, for lack of a better term, a really vague approach to how they're going to actually ensure that schools are doing their main job, which is educating kids and preparing them for the future, right? And I think that whether or not you use standardized tests, and I would personally argue that they are one very basic measure. They should be a floor and not a ceiling, but they can tell us something important in broad stroke about whether or not kids have basic skills and whether or not schools are equipping kids with basic skills. But I think that you can use other measures to also hold schools truly accountable for serving children and serving families. And what I mean by that is you have to have an accountability policy that has teeth. So whatever measure you choose to say, this is going to be our measure to determine whether or not schools are doing good by kids, when they're not doing well by kids, there have to be consequences attached. And I think that that was an important thing that came out of places like Massachusetts and Texas and California that was adopted under No Child Left Behind, but unfortunately in implementation failed in many respects. But I think that accountability has to remain, and we have to be really serious about it. And I'm, for one, frightened that the pendulum has swung a little bit too far the other way. I think that a complementary lesson that we can learn from that is that, you know, power to the educators. When we truly put power in the hands of people who are on the forefront of educating kids, those people want to be accountable. If they have the tools that they need to do what they know how to do best, and then they can show to the state, to the policymaker, that they're doing what they know how to do best and that it's getting good results for kids, then let's do that. And one of the failures, I think, of No Child Left Behind was that, you know, we had this overarching federal policy and states reacted in disparate ways. And a lot of that reaction involved taking power away from the people who are on the ground. So it's the charter school lesson, but really large writ, because autonomy really does matter. We see droves of people leaving this profession. And I would argue that, you know, everybody says, oh, teacher pay is low. Yes, it is in many places that needs to be fixed. But I think if you really have conversations with educators, a lot of them will tell you, this is not what I became an educator for, right? I became an educator because I have great ideas and I'm very educated about how kids learn and what different kinds of kids need, et cetera. And you have to empower educators to do what they know best. And I think that, you know, we have a little bit more of that to learn in Massachusetts, but I think generally we do a pretty good job. And that's something that that other states would do really well to learn.
Okay, and I appreciate this. This is incredible because that's something that I think is worth a second conversation and maybe a second podcast in the spring or sometime when you have a little bit of time, because that's a huge question and a huge concern. I think for me as a professional educator, somebody who chose this profession and who loves the policy aspect, but loves, you know, the work within the school. And it is that place where this is a different job than when I started, you know, back in 1997. And that's normal. And it's not being an old guy trying to say, I remember when, but it is a very different job. And you see people, even my age, leaving the profession because of that difference and because of some of the things that you mentioned. So if you're up for it, we'll do a second conversation sometime.
Anytime, my friend. Anytime.
Thank you, Kara. I appreciate it.